You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'd like to welcome you all here on behalf of the Open Society Fellowship Program to listen to Johnny Steinberg, Open Society Fellow. Johnny will be familiar to most of you, if not all of you, for his multiple appearances here at OSI in various capacities, whether he's speaking on policing techniques in South African townships or Liberian diaspora communities in Staten Island or politics in South Africa after Mandela and Mbeki. Johnny's range is astonishing, I think, to all of us. He is twice the recipient of South Africa's highest award for nonfiction, the Alan Paton Prize. He was nominated again this year. So his books are becoming a regular feature on their shortlist. The subject today of Johnny's talk is a recommendation by the Liberian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which issued a report this summer in July that Liberia's president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, be effectively banned from politics for 30 years on account of her support in her remote past for warlord Charles Taylor. And I gather from the popular media that the chief complaint against her is that she has not expressed remorse for that period of support. It comes as an irony, of course, to those of us who have believed that Johnson Sirleaf's presidency is a defiant and a very important step in the right direction for Africa, that she would be identified and linked so closely to war crimes committed by someone whose deeds have been amply recorded and played out in a very public tribunal. Without further ado, I'll let Johnny pick up the narrative from there. Thanks again to Johnny for speaking to all of us today.
Thanks very much, Steve. Everyone can hear, right? Great. we'll of course talk about Sirleaf, but I think as one moment in the broader context of this report, and we can focus on Sirleaf in the questions with pleasure. But to start at just the very, very broadest level, the Liberian Civil War began at the end of December 1989 and ended in August 2003. Up to 200,000 people were killed during that period. And the peace that ensued was very friendly to those who'd prosecuted the war. From 2004 onwards, warlords had prominent places in the public service, in elected governments, at the universities, in business. It was a peace very good to those who'd prosecuted the war. In late June, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which had since June 2006 gathered about 22,000 statements and interviewed about 500 witnesses, released its final report. And the final report threw a live wire into the post-war establishment. Firstly and most dramatically, it recommended that 98 Liberians be prosecuted by a special tribunal for war crimes and violations of international human rights law. Among those 98 people were senators, most famously Prince Johnson, one of the people who prosecuted the war from the start, a professor at the University of Liberia, Alhaji Kroma, another leading figure during the war and after, various associates of Charles Taylor's who were in the legislature, and various people who'd made a great deal of money during and after the war. So it was a real bombshell. The response of warlords was immediately to call a press conference where people who hadn't spoken to each other in years were together on the same platform, warning that the report was going to return Liberia to war. In the weeks after the report was released, several of the commissioners received death threats, some on the phone, some in hand delivered notes to their houses, and two of them went into hiding. There was also another list besides those 98 recommended for prosecution, and that was a list of 50 people, initially 52, and then the report was withdrawn and released again an hour later with 50. and those people were censured, or recommended for censured. It was recommended that the legislature pass a law censoring them for the support, financial and otherwise, which they gave armed factions. And famously among those people was the sitting president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And the result of that is that warlords responded very badly to the report. So did all of Johnson's allies, progressive organizations throughout the world. There was this extraordinary silence. Hillary Clinton visited Liberia in the weeks after the report and said absolutely nothing about it, went out of her way to say nothing about it, despite the fact that the country was speaking of little else. Amnesty International, which had been very vocal and very opinionated about transitional justice in Liberia, said absolutely nothing, released no statement. So there was this very awkward silence from progressive organizations and from Western governments. This was in contrast to what was happening on the streets of Liberia. I was fortunate enough to be in the country for just over 2 weeks right after the report was released, and spent a fair amount of time on street level debating societies in three cities, in soccer clubs, in people's homes. And there was enormous, enormous excitement among ordinary people about this report. Essentially, because in the context where people really had got away with murder, here was an official report which named names, and that was the first time that had happened. And the groundswell of excitement about that was enormous. Which leads one to conclude, and I'll say this now and argue it through the rest of the next 10 minutes or so, that an enormous, enormous opportunity has been missed, because this is clearly a country which is craving a war crimes tribunal. It is craving justice for people who prosecuted the war. And there's every chance that that popular support would have turned to reality if the report had been a good one. Instead, it's an atrocious one. There's very little reasoning in it. It breaks the rule of law over and over again on the most broad and generous definition of the rule of law. And the result is that there probably never will be a war crimes tribunal in Liberia, even though there really could have been one. And the results really will be to deepen a wedge, an already very deep wedge, between governors and governed in Liberia. I mean, the governing class is all rallying against this report. The governed are all rallying, well, primarily rallying for it. And the legacy of the report will probably be to remind people that they hate their rulers, and always have and probably always will, despite the fact that there's a democracy now. And it's very difficult to imagine Liberia overcoming its many problems with that sort of relationship between rulers and ruled. So it's a missed opportunity. But to start at the beginning and to go to where Truth Commission arose from, the idea of a truth commission was sealed in August 2003 at the negotiations that ended the civil war in Accra, Ghana. And I think the most important thing about those negotiations is to be to understand that all of those who prosecuted Liberia's civil war at any stage, in all stages during those 14 years, were essentially after power and wealth, and were very very quick and adept at switching from war to politics to achieve power and wealth, and did so several times during those 14 years. And this was another such event. It was understood that peace was inevitable, mainly because the West African region and the United States would not tolerate war any longer. It was understood that there would be peace, and this conference was essentially about dividing the spoils of the peace. And it was really nakedly so. At that stage, an organization called LIRD was bombarding Monrovia, and that was being broadcast live on CNN, and there were television sets in the negotiation process. And there were one or two occasions where a negotiator would be losing negotiations to get a government ministry or a position, and would literally phone commanders in the field and order a bombardment, which would be watched in the negotiation process, and that person would be given their ministry. It was very, very transparent and crude bargaining for the spoils of the peace. And there were many other people with negotiations too. There was an enormous civil society representation and peaceful political parties, but they were very quickly sidelined because it was understood that those with the cannons and the mortars were the ones who could start or end the war, and they must be at the center. So what happened was quite ugly. A lot of political people, a lot of peaceful political people began lining up behind warlords for jobs because they knew that the warlords were calling the shots. So it was an ugly process. And it was assumed by the warlords that they would not be prosecuted, that they were there not to be prosecuted. So the idea of a war crimes tribunal came up and was quickly squashed and replaced by the idea of a truth commission. And although it wasn't said openly, what a truth commission meant was not a tribunal. What a truth commission meant was amnesty. Now, oddly enough, it was never written down during the entire negotiation process that people would get amnesty. And the reason is interesting. The civil society organizations had really been pushed to the margins, but they were still very loud and could make a noise. And if anyone actually proposed a motion, you know, out loud, that gets written down, that there'd be a blanket amnesty, you know, it would raise their hackles. And nobody wants to be the one to stand up and say, we need amnesty, because it's embarrassing. You're immediately declaring that you're guilty of crimes. So it was understood that there wouldn't be, even though it wouldn't be written down. You know, Liberia's justice system was in tatters. There'd be no institution capable of prosecuting war crimes. All international players were saying nobody is interested in prosecuting. All the armed factions were saying nobody's interested. So it was felt that it didn't need to be written down. It would simply be embarrassing. So let it pass. Peace came to Liberia, and there was democratic elections in December 2005. Constituting a truth commission and writing a truth commission act was an incredibly conflict-ridden and drawn-out process, which lasted about 18 months. The main sticking points were how the commissioners would be selected. But when an act was written, it actually gave the truth commission only a very circumscribed power to give amnesty. It was forbidden to give amnesty to anybody considered guilty of war crimes or violators of international human rights law. And famously now, it gave the Truth Commission the power to recommend people for prosecution and censure. And didn't give those recommendations the power of law, but almost. There were very little grounds on which to contest them. And again, the reason that happened was really the embarrassment of saying out loud that we want an amnesty. There were various people in the legislature who were arguing vociferously for it behind closed doors, but wouldn't go out into the open to say, I am a murderer, therefore give me amnesty. And again, it was, you know, assurances behind the scenes. There is no institution to prosecute these crimes. There's no chance. Let's just move ahead. The Truth Commission began its work, and I think most of those who prosecuted the war were fairly comfortable that the Truth Commission would do very little to them, for the simple reason that they were very powerful and the Truth Commission was very weak. The Truth Commission had 9 commissioners, none of whom was a man or woman of great stature. The head of the commission was a young human rights lawyer who was really a lightweight in Liberia. Now, Liberia is a very small country with a very small elite. And it was understood that these people would be truth commissioners for 2 or 3 years, and then they'd be looking for a job. And they'd need more powerful people behind them if they were going to get the sort of job they wanted. They didn't have the independence, the informal independence, or the leverage to truly have any clout. They were also massively underfunded. You know, it was doubtful whether they'd ever have enough investigative capacity to gather credible evidence that anybody had done anything. They had very, very little in-house legal expertise. Amnesty International, as late as late 2008, complained that they didn't have the expertise to even determine what was war crime and what wasn't. So it wasn't an institution taken very seriously. And at first, the warlords didn't even bother to come. Eventually, in March 2008, the TRC wrote a very scrambled, complicated policy document, and one of the clauses said that anybody coming can get blanket immunity. And then everybody came after that. But nonetheless, didn't apply for immunity because that meant they'd done something wrong. So the same silence emerged, that people believed nothing would happen but couldn't actually get it written down on paper. And when warlords did start coming, it was an absolute fiasco. Warlords came with huge fanfare and press behind them, used the TRC to grandstand, to lie very openly about what they had and hadn't done during the war, to vastly overestimate what their enemies had done during the war. And the TRC largely sat in silence and didn't cross-examine them, or cross-examined them very tepidly and very shyly, having cross-examined witnesses very robustly. And they were hammered for that. They were regarded as morally confused. Article in African Affairs essentially said they're rounding on victims and supporting perpetrators. And this is what happens after 14 years of civil war. People forget the difference between right and wrong, and that it's happened to the commissioners themselves. So it was really a very embarrassing situation. Warlords went to the commission and called commissioners, you know, in open hearings by their first name, or by the word Pekin, which in Liberian English means little boy. So warlords came and said, here we are, but try and do anything to us. You're too weak, you can't. The hearings ended, and in June, the commission releases its report and absolutely stuns everybody with what it says. And there's immediately great support for this in the streets of Monrovia. It was unexpected, and many ordinary people welcome it. And it's difficult but to imagine that this is a minnow's vengeance. They were put through the truth commissioners were put through the most humiliating exercise, you know, for 3 years. And I think what they were saying was, stop all of you. we've got this power and we're going to use it. Unfortunately, what they did was produce a bizarre document. You know, those 98 people recommended for prosecution, many of them are not mentioned anywhere in the document except that they must be prosecuted, just that their name's on a list. So there's absolutely no sense of what they did or didn't do during the war. You know, there's no way that alone could pass judicial review. Other really crazy things in the document, the infamous General Butt Naked, who led a naked battalion of people during the war and went to the commission and boasted that he killed 20,000 people personally. He, the commission recommended, be exonerated on the grounds that he came forward and atoned and told the whole truth. And he clearly came to grandstand. He's made a career after the war by being an ex-warlord, Christian converted ex-warlord. And perhaps most egregious is this list of 50 people who stand to be censured. I mean, at least those recommended for prosecution would face a trial and would be able to defend themselves. With the 50 censured people, they don't have that privilege. They're simply censured. If this these recommendations become law, then that's it. You know, they've been declared as financiers and supporters of warlords and can't stand for public office for 30 years. And I mean, in regards to Johnson Sirleaf, she came to the commission. She kicked and screamed a bit first, but she did come to the commission. And she said, I supported Taylor in the first half of 1990. I gave him $10,000 to feed his troops and to feed civilians trapped behind his lines. And then when I saw who he was, I withdrew my support. And she said the same in her autobiography, which was published this year. Now, it's quite possible that she supported Taylor for longer than she said and gave more support than she said, but the point is there's no evidence that she did. As things stand, she's the sitting president who came to the Truth Commission and apologized, which is what a Truth Commission's for. The commission says that they got access to CIA files. This is what they said to me in an interview, which shows that her support was considerably more extensive. But asked what was in that files, they say they can't say. So they have evidence that they're not prepared to give. As things stand, there isn't any at all. But just to say that it's a poor report and you know, a bunch of very weak people trying to be strong is just the beginning of the story. And it may help to go into some detail about some of the responses to the report that I saw on the ground. There are these very interesting street-level societies in Monrovia called Hatai, which Hatai is a green tea. Refugees from the war returning from Guinea in the late 1990s brought this tradition back. And it's largely men, largely unemployed people, and they gather in venues in central Monrovia at about 10 or 11 in the morning, and they spend the first bit of the day reading the newspaper, discussing events. And in mid-afternoon, what kicks off is a formalized debate with a secretary and a moderator, and each society has a president and a treasurer. And they spend from about 3 in the afternoon till 9 or 10 at night debating, informal debates, the issues of the day. And the cultural and political story behind the formation of these organizations is very interesting. It's difficult to exaggerate how much Liberia detests its elite, and particularly how much it detests people it calls book people. Intellectuals, and not just the old American-Liberian elites, which ruled Liberia to 1980, but also the so-called progressive intelligentsia, which overthrew the elites in 1980. They were very, very sullied by the war. As one member of a Hatay society put it to me, the war was prosecuted by people who were friends in the early 1980s and then fell out. And that's essentially true. Very few people. Oh, the other thing he said is what else they all have in common is they all have graduate degrees from America, which is also true. Politics is reviled, elites are reviled, and intellectuals are reviled. And essentially these Hatay societies are very self-consciously jargonized. They use quasi-scientific language with sort of old Marxist inflections. And essentially they're saying, we can talk book two. And nothing you ever say again is going to pass over our heads because we can talk the same way. So it's very much a populist, ordinary person's response to a loathed intelligentsia. And as a guest at two of these debates, I was allowed to choose the choice of debates. And I, one obvious question was, should the president be on the list of those censured? And there was lively debate. But what was interesting was that people who supported her, people who voted for her, yes, said, yes, of course she must be on that list. Of course she must. And why? And the answer is, she's in the elite. She must be guilty. Many people said that, de facto. And if she wasn't exactly guilty of that, then of many other things, because she's in the elite. And another person said to me, I think sort of perhaps the most enlightening thing I heard about this report is that it's becoming canonized as a sacred document among ordinary people. And probably generations from now, there'll be old illiterate men and women who can't read the report because they can't read, but who will nonetheless know by heart every single name on the list, because it's the one official document that named the people who killed, the people who prosecuted the war. And just informally in the fabric of Liberian life, it's a document that's going to live a long time and be a very weighty document, despite all its faults. And that's fascinating and good. I mean, good that there'll be some form of account, even if it's informal and even if it's only in these societies and in clubs and debating societies. But it's also a terrible missed opportunity, because clearly with this level of popular support, it would have been politically practicable. It would have been possible to have a war crimes tribunal. And that many, many sections and factions in the elite could easily have been behind this document if the innocent hadn't have been thrown in with the guilty. So a jurisprudentially sound, rigorous, sober document would probably have got Johnson Sirleaf's support and many others. Probably would have isolated those who had prosecuted the war and could well have seen them behind bars. And that's important not just for the sake of justice, but probably because it's the only foundation on which Liberia can make a break with its past, to actually see those who prosecuted the war behind bars would be potentially to say that Liberian public sphere is one which has to an extent been cleansed, that leaders are perhaps people who can be identified with, that there can be some sort of unity between governed and governors. In the end, the effect of the report is going to be the exact opposite. The governors rally against the report, many ordinary people rally for it, and it simply reminds people that not enough has changed, that murderers did get away with murder, that the whole elite supports them, and the wedge between ordinary people and the elite widens and is deepened. And that's a huge drag, a huge weight on the country. I mean, it has enormous, enormous tasks to accomplish. And with politics as tarnished as it is, regarded simply as a sphere for self-interest, the chances of anybody governing Liberia cleanly or well are very difficult. A very important opportunity, real opportunity at some sort of rebirth, perhaps the only one, was missed. Questions, comments? Lots more to say about Johnson Sirleaf.
Thank you very much, Johnny. That was really very clarifying and fascinating. If anybody does have a question, remember this event is being recorded and you should speak into the microphone, which Lisena will deliver to you.
Thank you very much, Johnny. That was really fascinating. And fascinating for us. I'm Tracy Gerd. I'm with the International Justice section with the Justice Initiative, and I actually do a blog on the Charles Taylor trial, and within that a number of Liberians, particularly Liberians diaspora, tend to comment on that every day, and this has been one of the issues that have been coming up for a discussion, and I think the comments that we've been getting have reinforced a lot of what you've been saying. Firstly, there's disappointment on two things. There was a lot of support for the war crimes tribunals. There was a real hope that this could move forward the rule of law for Liberia among a lot of people on the side. But they were disappointed about two things. One is they said that people who were supporting a war crimes tribunal in Liberia were actually getting locked up and shunted away, and there was silence about it, not only by the human rights community but internationally as well. So there was disappointment that there wasn't a movement towards that. And then secondly, even though the US, for example, has said that they would support a war crimes tribunal if the Liberian people asked for it, there was also a sense that Liberians themselves didn't feel they had the agency to push for that to go forward. They didn't feel that they would get the support by the political elite. So I'm just curious, actually, from you to hear if there is any scope, despite what you've said, for a war crimes tribunal to go ahead, whether a civil society could push it forward, for example, whether there could be some help from the outside that could help promote this, and what your thoughts are on that. Thanks, Johnny.
Well, the first point of people getting locked up for calling for war crimes, there is one particularly incendiary leader who stands up and goes absolutely berserk on radio every now and again, who and he's the head of an organization which calls for war crimes. That's what the organization does. And yes. And I don't know whether John Sirleaf himself was behind us, but he was locked up, and it was a terrible mistake. He was locked up for several days by after he'd gone after the president's son. So it was very unfortunate. It looked like the president lost her rag and had him thrown in jail. And in her defense, she's never done that before or since. If you compare Liberia from 2006 to all of its past, people can speak freely for the first time. Under Doe, people were taken away and killed for much, much less than that, for doing nothing, for his suspecting that you may have said something. Under Tubman, similarly, very, very autocratic and no freedom of speech, and that's the one blemish on her freedom of speech record. And it was a terrible slip, but it really was a slip. It doesn't represent her over the last 3 years. I don't think there is an opportunity for a war crimes tribunal after this report. And the feeling I got from the people in the Hatay and other places was one of utter resignation. You know, idea that the elite decides things and we don't. The very idea of a civil society led, civil society spearheading something this radical and this consequential is probably unthinkable in Liberia. The people screaming and shouting in the Hatay were also very resigned and also didn't believe themselves to be powerful. Which is part of the damage the report's done. It's just reinforced the fact the resignation and fatalism that Liberia is ruled by greedy, self-interested people, and there's nothing to do about it. So it's just, it's part of an ongoing syndrome.
My name is Amanda Wetzel, and I'm also with the Justice Initiative. And I was wondering what the you talked a bit about the wider community's engagement with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission after the report was released. But I was wondering if you could talk about the procedure that the commission used to question the individuals who were brought before it, and if there was the opportunity for kind of victim engagement with the individuals who testified before the commission.
Yeah. To be honest, I'm not very knowledgeable in that. I'm not sure if any formal access was given to perpetrators by victims. I know that they collected an extraordinary amount of victim statements, nearly 20,000 inside Liberia, several thousand outside Liberia, in particularly in a large refugee camp in Ghana, and a few hundred here in America. And those people were encouraged to name perpetrators so that investigators could verify what they'd said. In the end, it's difficult to know exactly what TRC investigators did. there were very few of them, certainly not enough to investigate what 20,000 people had said. And I mean, the general commentary was that victims were very poorly treated in the TRC. They were cross-examined very thoroughly, sometimes very robustly. Often not because commissioners doubted what they said, but because they wanted to squeeze as much information as they could from victims. But the experience of being a victim was to give your story and to be quite harshly cross-examined about it. In contrast to perpetrators whose testimony was live on the radio and they were cross-examined by very shy commissioners. I mean, there are people who can say much more than I could about exactly how victims were treated and what their experience was.
I'm interested in the split that, my name is Julia Harrington, I'm from the Equality and Citizenship Program of the Justice Initiative. The split that you describe between the ordinary people and the elites and their belief that Johnson Sirleaf must be guilty of things and must be punished because she's part of the elite. Does this mean that there's really no opportunity for rehabilitation of people's beliefs in government? That from the outside, Johnson Sirleaf was thought to be that leader who would not be corrupt and who would govern the country properly and should therefore restore people's faith in government. But it seems as if it doesn't matter what she does in office. It's her identity as an educated person or foreign educated person means that she's disliked and indeed the masses want her out of politics. So what kind of political leadership can Liberia expect in the future with this sort of
dynamic? a number of things to say about that. The first is that I think that a war crimes tribunal was probably the only mechanism that Liberia has available to renew politics in any serious and substantial way. Just that there was a terrible war in which people openly committed murder, and they're now very powerful. And nothing short of bringing those people to justice, I think, is going to really change politics. Were those people not just roaming free, but really living off the spoils of the peace and wielding political power quite considerably? It's very difficult to imagine what short of their prosecution is going to renew people's faith in politics. At the moment, things are so openly cynical. I mean, in regard to Johnson Sirleaf, she's certainly no war criminal by any stretch of the imagination. She didn't prosecute the war. She has no blood in her hands. Nonetheless, the gap between who she is internationally and who she is in Liberia is enormous. I think people voted for her because of her influence and because of influence among Western agencies and governments and the idea that she could bring a lot of aid. But, oh, that's my phone. I mean, her history in Liberian politics makes her very unlovable. She really is an arch pragmatist, and she's prepared to work with anybody and has worked with almost everybody. Going back to the 1970s when she was the finance minister in Tolbert's regime, she was at the heart of the elite. She was one of the more enlightened members of the elite. She'd gotten to the elite despite having a native background, a very interesting personal story. But she was certainly prepared, she certainly believed that the best way to conduct politics was among those in power, and she's always believed that. When Doe overthrew the old elite, she worked very closely with Doe until he threw her out. She was prepared to work with him much longer. She was watching before her eyes him execute people he didn't like, but believed that staying close to him was the best that she could do. It wasn't a bad person's decision, it was a very pragmatic decision. And exactly the same with Charles Taylor. When he invaded Liberia, she knew some of what he was capable of. She certainly knew that he was a loose cannon and with arms may do terrible things, but felt that she must support him because it was the best chance of getting rid of Doe. Now, in contemporary Liberian politics, she's allied herself to extremely corrupt people, Greaves being only the most loud version. She's somebody who throws herself into the status quo and tries to do the best with that. The status quo in Liberia most of the time is quite a horrible place. So I think to an ordinary Liberian, she may be the first woman president in Africa. She may be somebody who speaks with conviction and great articulateness about human rights to international audiences. But she comes with a history of which people are wary. And certainly they like her enough to make her president. And she may well become president again if she stands in 2011. It's uncertain. But she's not loved, and for good reason.
Maybe I'll throw in a question or two here, Johnny. When Doe overthrew Tolbert in 1980, it was depicted certainly in the popular media as a kind of Robespierrean throwing out of the elites. It was a populist revolution. And then it transpired that populist revolution became corrupted and was no longer viewed as a legitimate, you know, representative of the popular will. So it seems ironic that, it seems doubly ironic that a truth and reconciliation process, which is normally in some way the product of the intelligentsia, the intelligentsia's exertions, I mean the intelligentsia in the form of civil society, of human rights activists, university professors, and others who come together to demand this kind of thing. It's ironic that it would be conscripted in the name of, you know, in the name of a people who have been represented and then betrayed by successive pretenders to the throne. Can you revisit exactly the mechanics by which a process that's normally driven in the name of, if not in the name, at least by the efforts of the intelligentsia could come to be a cudgel used to oppose it in such forceful terms?
You mean the TRC?
The actual TRC.
Supported by the intelligentsia and then turned against it, so its final report turned against the intelligentsia.
I
mean, I've been guilty in part in talking in shorthand and talking about the elites and the intelligentsia, and obviously the relationship between people who are educated and people who aren't is more porous than the shorthand that I've been suggesting. I'm thinking how best to describe it. I think that's maybe the best way is just to describe what I understand it to mean when somebody at a Hatai gets up and starts speaking in intellectual language and what that means. And these Hatai people compete with one another to speak in the most opaque jargon they possibly can because it's believed that somebody who can talk about Hegelian contradictions and theses and antitheses is very clever.
And
I mean, people's relation to the intelligentsia is very, very fraught. It's something to which people deeply aspire, and it's something which people enormously, enormously resent. You know, to be able to stand up and talk about thesis and antithesis is to wield power over somebody. So it's something people want to do, and it's something people resent. And yes, but parts of the intelligentsia supported the TRC very militantly and very well. But in the end, what comes out, what has to come out of anything in Liberia is resentment to the intelligentsia. It has to happen in one form or another, because I come from South Africa where this is also acute, but not even a thousandth of a match in Liberia, is that inequality is so deeply under people's skin. Inferiority complexes, thin-skinnedness, you know, the idea that somebody who knows a little better than you is going to be nasty to you. It's a pervasive national trait, and it's going to get expressed in anything of importance, and this is how it was expressed in this document. If it had been a good document, that same tension would have come out in another way, and in a way that may have been easier to manage. I don't know if that begins to answer.
Ari Korpivaara, the communications office. Could you talk a little bit more about the Hatai? It sounds like they're the wannabe elite, and that would seem to make them few, you know, not the ordinary citizen, but someplace in between the two. So so you talked about them as being representing the ordinary citizens. Is that, do they truly represent that, or is it like any other society where the people who engage and actually discuss the issues, you know, all day long are just a handful?
Well, they're not representative in the sense that they're almost all men. And yes, out of all the unemployed men in Liberia, they're the ones who are prepared to discuss politics all day, and that does make them, by definition, an unrepresentative category, because not all unemployed men want to do that. But they're taken very, very seriously by politicians and by public officials. They're regarded as a real weather vane of the weather on the ground. And you know, to the extent that the president has gone to address one of the Hatayi societies, and members of the elite I speak to, you know, they talk of going there and being quite fearful of going there. They're sort of stripped bare. Nobody calls you professor or doctor. They want to know what you think, and they ask you in very robust ways. You know, I've met with members of the elite who are unbelievably arrogant people who, in normal conversation, who go down to Hatayi and are really humble. I mean, essentially they form, well, they, I mean, they have an interesting history and a short history, because they only, you know, they were imported from refugees coming back from Guinea in the late 90s. But in the late 90s, they drank tea and read the newspaper very carefully and didn't do much more than that. Where they actually became formal societies was when, in the eve of the 2005 elections, where the members of the society said, we have people campaigning to govern us and we need them to speak to us in the sorts of forums they never have before. And that's when they formalized themselves and got presidents and treasurers and moderators, and they invited candidates to come and speak. And once they did, their membership swelled to thousands upon thousands. And it's now back to hundreds because it isn't an election campaign. But it's an organic grassroots structure that really is about ordinary people, and is about ordinary people's quests to communicate with the people who govern them, and in some way to hold them to account. And it brings a lot of Liberian baggage into them that I've kind of made fun of here and spoken about. The, you know, for me, an outsider, the level of jargon they use is amusing. But it's also very, very telling. You know, it's about generations of being bullied and not wanting to be bullied anymore.
Like they do have influence, even though they might feel powerless.
People are quite afraid of them. You know, people in Liberia, people are afraid of a lot of things. People are afraid of any crowd that forms on the streets. It's a very, very volatile place. There's no real working police force. You know, there's nominally a police force, but it's not really there on the ground. And if somebody is seen to commit a crime, to steal a cell phone in the streets, people shout rogue and a crowd develops and they kill him. You know, that mob justice is there every day. And, you know, it's a sign of the fact that the foundations of stability are still frail. There was an occasion when teachers went on strike and President Johnson Sirleaf went to address them and scolded them. She said, you teachers of the young, you know, you're being selfish, go and teach. And what happened is that the students rallied around the teachers and went and marched on her office and locked her in. And when that happened, a Nigerian contingent of riot police was called in to break this up immediately, because the very spectacle of ordinary people gathering with some animosity around the president's office can't be tolerated. So the high tide, people are worried about that time because they're worried about ordinary people gathering. It's a, you know, Liberia is a fragile place.
When the Hatayi meet to invoke Hegel to express the popular will, to what extent is there a kind of anti-Western capitalist? I mean, are they railing against Firestone and against, you know, the international free trade regime? Is there a kind of anti-capitalist subtext to their populism, or not particularly?
Well, there are all sorts of views in the Hatayi. So, I mean, yes, there's a long anti-capitalist tradition in Liberia, evidenced in the Hegelian language. But I think the complexity of the world is expressed in that type, often by people, single people expressing very different opinions. The last time I visited Hatai last year, I was also allowed to choose the topic of debate, and the topic I chose was, if Charles Taylor is acquitted and comes home, should he be allowed to stand in the 2011 election? And they split exactly in half. And half of them said, not only should he be able to stand, but he should win. And the other half said, what he's done should not allow him to come back here at all. He mustn't be allowed back on this country's soil. And part of the pro-Taylor people was an anti-capitalist voice, surprisingly enough, even though he himself is avowedly pro-capitalist. They were saying he's African. We're led by a woman whose best friends are white and foreign and live in Washington, and Charles Taylor is an African. Let's be led by one of ours. The opponents were saying he's a murderer. He's a mass murderer. You don't want an African like that. You would rather have somebody who is connected to Washington and can bring development. So, and some people switched from one camp to another, throughout the debate. Both were quite alluring. But you really had both camps represented in the same, among the same people and in the same meeting. Mark.
I'm Mark Schuf's, also a fellow. So let's say that for some reason Ellen Johnson Sirleaf vanished from the political stage because she resigned, she didn't run again, whatever, she's barred from politics for 30 years because of this report, whatever. Who are the likely people to come forth to take her place, and how would they rank in terms of their ability to lead the country in a
right,
progressive, democratic, and prosperous direction?
Mm. Well, what I say comes with a health warning because I don't live there, and I don't experience the country day to day. And my answer to a question like that is inferior to somebody who does live there from day to day. So be advised. but from what I hear and from the many people I spoke to when I visited in July, it's likely that the people who stood against her in 2005 are all in the running. And that's George Weah, the famous footballer, a man called Brumskin from the old elite. The talk is that it could well be between those two and whoever from Sirleaf Johnson's party stands, whether it's her or somebody else. And George Weah is a very interesting character. He's a megastar there. He grew up in a slum in Monrovia, and he became a household name across the world because he plays soccer. And he's much loved by many people. And the main component of his campaign in 2005 was to say, vote for me because I'm not educated. Look at what educated people have done to this country. They've destroyed it. I'm one of you. I'm not one of them. And that had enormous appeal. And why he lost is, it's an open question, but an interesting one, because he won the first round, and he was trounced comprehensively by Sirleaf in the second round, but he did win the first round. And there are any number of reasons. Perhaps the most hopeful reason is that people realized that he was a good soccer player, but not a good politician. And although he sounded good, that's not good enough to run a country. Whereas Sirleaf had some experience of governing. But other things happened just before the election. One is that Sirleaf's people, they ran a very astute campaign. And Weah happened to visit the Crown County of Liberia, Grand Jetty. And Doe was a Crown. And Doe and Weah were very close because they were both fanatical about soccer. And Sirleaf's people managed to spin that as a story that Weah was a Crown revivalist and was going to bring people who tried to commit genocide back to power. And they spun that story very well. And that's part of the reason that she won so well. She took the northern counties by storm as a result of that. Which is a long way of saying that who wins the next election is very, very open. apparently, she herself is calculating as best she can whether she'll win. And she'll run if she believes that she will win. And she's imported American polling techniques very successfully into Liberia, so she probably will have a good idea whether she's going to win, and if she runs will be a good signal on what's going to happen. You know, Ware and Bram Skinner are both very, very inferior people and politicians to Sirleaf, and they won't run Liberia as well. Whether they have the savvy to know that they must keep Liberia stable, I don't know. I mean, it faces an uncertain future without her, essentially. She's probably the best person to be running that country, and whether somebody nearly as good as her will take over is really an open question. Julie.
It's a very brief question.
Sorry, you meant to be doing
that. What are the chances of the recommendations going into effect or becoming law? Are there any?
I'd say almost none. I mean, for two reasons. One is that a lot of the people on the lists are in all major political parties, and they're going to do... the legislature needs to make this law for it to happen, and the legislature doesn't want to make it law. So that they can find reasons not to. And more importantly, they can find many legitimate reasons not to, because it's such a crazy report. You know, it hasn't gone to the Supreme Court, but I can't imagine a vaguely sane Supreme Court allowing it. It's a truly mad document. You know, if it was a very rigorous and sound document, I think that would be a very different story. I think that Sirleaf's party may well be behind it. The judiciary may well okay it. And suddenly these warlords who have always been so comfortable that nothing will ever happen may have found themselves isolated. But that isn't going to happen.
It's not really a question, but I just wanted to, as a side note, that Weah actually went and got an education. Well, he got a high school diploma,
yeah.
And he's very proud of that, so he's going to use that in the next election, whether or not that makes any difference, but he now does have a high school diploma. Also to say, Sirleaf is behaving a little oddly in the last couple of months with respect to the region, and I find it very curious for her to do on the eve of, you know, an election year. She's become very much sort of controlled by someone who's not that reputable, and that's President Wade of Senegal. So, for instance, recently she and President Wade traveled to Guinea. You know, they experienced a coup not so long ago, and elections are forthcoming. They'll be in January. And on this visit, which it wasn't reported in the media this way, but it was on local television, she got up on a stage with President Wade and began sort of calling for the coup leader, Kamara Kandish, or whatever his name is, to rule. And the people were very excited about that and became this big rally for someone who unconstitutionally changed government, which is, of course, against ECOWAS and AU rules. That was sort of one indication of where she's heading. Bringing back the death penalty was another, which is certainly something we need to seriously look at in terms of governance. And I just think she's kind of strangely finding her feet in this new realm of politics. And I think actually it's worth watching in a very serious way, whether or not she is the promise of Liberia.
Well, can I ask you a question? I mean, she's always been very quickly and enormously pragmatic. What do you think is behind this pragmatism? Why is she doing that?
I don't know why she would, but, you know, Wade has always had this weird influence over her, and I'm really not certain as to why. I mean, you know, he is the old man of the Union, but, or of ECOWAS, but it's not like there's any money between the countries or anything, so not quite sure. Maybe it's because there's nothing coming from Nigeria, the usual powerhouse. I mean, it's like, is the president alive, essentially? So, you know, I don't really know, but there are a few things happening domestically and regionally that gives one a little bit of, you know, what's really going on there. So it's quite interesting,
right.
You know, your sort of report of the domestic situation, and when you look at what she's doing politically on the world stage, just something to watch.
Johnny, just one more question. How
How is the TRC report being perceived amongst the diaspora, in particular here in Staten Island? Is it different to how it's being perceived in Liberia?
I'd say the main difference is that people in Liberia are resigned that it won't be implemented. People in the diaspora are utterly outraged that it might not be implemented. I think that diaspora has a much greater sense of its own efficacy and its capacity as a lobby to change the world. And I think that almost all diasporas, its views are more extreme. You know, it's an irony that people further away experience things more deeply. But certainly this diaspora is. Tomorrow, going to Minneapolis to a TRC report back meeting, which should be fiery. I went to one in Atlanta a few weeks ago, and it was fascinating. I mean, just a quick anecdote, and something I'd never seen before, and it really struck me, is somebody in the audience stood up and said, well, maybe this is so controversial, perhaps there should be a referendum. And if the people want this report, then they should get it. And somebody took severe issue with that and said, it is not up to the people of Liberia. This is law. These are crimes. These are murders. And if we are not going to put them away, then the ICC will. And he got a standing ovation. What is for me about that is firstly the idea of international law and the ICC being such a populist instrument, because there's so many populists who are against it. It's interesting to see that inversion. But for me it was a cry and a plea saying that our public sphere is so corrupted that the chances of it ever doing anything impartial are so slim that you need an authority that stands right above Liberia and doesn't even come from Liberia in order to bring justice to Liberia. And the fact that that got the standing ovation, that was the populist call among Liberians, speaks volumes for me about how Liberians believe that their polity is so corroded that it can't do anything, that to represent Liberian aspirations and desires, you need something non-Liberian to come and intervene. I thought it was quite a sad moment.
This document mad, and I just, and you said that it's not rigorous and it doesn't sort of put forth a logical argument as to why person X should be put on trial and why person Y should be censured. So give us a flavor of this madness.
Well, I think the madness is more in its omissions than its commissions and the juxtaposition between different things it says. I think it truly is mad to put somebody's name on a list to be prosecuted for murder and torture without having mentioned that person before. There's no evidence anywhere in the document that the person exists, never mind that they committed murder. I mean, it's a strange thing to do to a human being, to put them on a list as a murderer and a torturer without mentioning them before, without nothing in the narrative of the report suggests that that person exists, never mind that they did anything.
Absolutely no evidence whatsoever.
They're not mentioned anywhere. One doesn't know whether any witness or statement taker mentioned them because they don't talk about it. So there's one, you know, I think that's at the edge. And other things that I think are really at the edge are some of the juxtapositions. I mean, the fact that General Butt Naked is exonerated because he came to the commission and spoke the truth, where what he did was really come to the commission to promote his own career, because his career is as somebody who publicizes the fact that he killed many people and now doesn't. You know, that's how he earns a living. You know, the fact that he is exonerated, whereas the president of the country did come forward in all humility and apologize. And there's no evidence that she didn't disclose the whole truth, but she can't run for 30 years. I mean, to say that General Butt Naked can run for president, but Sirleaf Johnson can't, you know, because of their respective roles in the war, I think is an exemplar of such deep moral confusion. So I think it's a morally mad document at that level. You know, that juxtaposition, I think, is morally crazy.
Basharath, do you want to ask, did you have a question? Oh, you were leaning forward. Okay. Well, if there are no more questions, I want to thank all of you for coming out on Yom Kippur. And thanks especially to Johnny for another enlightening session. I feel much more up to speed on these events than I did before. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.